From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, deepening the probe into the death of a 20-year-old Muslim Marine recruit from Taylor.
There was another Muslim who filed a complaint against the same drill instructor only months before Siddiqui's death.
I want to make sure that the military service holds those people accountable and that we see this move forward.
Plus, the State Board of Education releases its revised school guidelines for LGBT students.
And I think most schools do want to create an environment that maximizes safety, privacy, and comfort for all their kids. And this is guidance about how to do that.
Building a bicycling community in Traverse City.
Grandmas and millennials and everybody in between, the idea of people on bikes creates more people on bikes, and you know, we really try to push the social aspect of meeting neighbors.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The State Board of Education will vote today on revised proposed guidelines regarding LGBT students at Michigan public schools. We'll talk with the president of the State Board of Education about that later this hour. Also, is human activity creating a new geological epoch? A Michigan researcher says yes. A Traverse City group's trying to bring back the concept of kids bicycling to school, and a West Michigan musician uses music to overcome depression. But first, the U.S. Marine Corps says a 20-year-old Taylor man likely committed suicide by jumping 40 feet from a stairwell. The family of Rahil Siddiqui says absolutely not. Siddiqui was a Palestinian-American Muslim 11 days into his basic Marine training on Paris Island when he died. Last week, the Marines announced that 20 members of the Paris Island staff could face criminal charges or discipline. Central to that is the revelation Siddiqui's drill sergeant was already under investigation for improper behavior, and he should not have been put in charge of recruits. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell has been pushing for a full investigation into what happened to her constituent, Rahil Siddiqui, and she is with us now. Congresswoman, what have you been told by the Marines about this recruit's death?
Well, I want to be very careful, Cindy, because I think it is very, very, very important that the people that are responsible are held accountable. And the Marine Corps commandant came and met with me last Thursday. They have taken this investigation very seriously, and it clearly turned up things that were deeply disturbing. I think probably the revelation that puts this for all of us so that we can really understand some of the incidences were happening is a young Muslim man who completed boot camp, but during his training was put in a clothes dryer multiple times and actually burned because he turned the heat on. He survived boot camp, but that same drill sergeant that did it to him was the drill sergeant for Recruit Siddiqui. You and I are never going to know what happened that morning because we weren't there. But this is a young man who was a class valedictorian, and every person that I have talked to talks about what a special person he was. And he wanted to go fight to defend this country that you and I love because he really understands what so many of us take for granted, freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And no matter what I do, and no matter what all of us do, we can never bring that young man back for his family.
There are three investigations underway, and there's also a call from the Council on American Islamic Relations to the Department of Justice for a civil rights investigation. What do we watch for? What are you watching for?
Right now, I believe that the Marines undertook a serious investigation. They have identified at least 20 people that need to be held responsible for different things that were found. I want to make sure that the military service holds those people accountable and that we see this move forward. And at the same time, significant changes are made so that what happened there never happens again to a young man or woman going into the military to defend us.
Do you believe in your heart that Muslims have reason to fear for their safety if they join the Marines or really any branch of the U.S. military?
I don't think it's every place. What is most concerning to me is that we need a very diverse military. We need people to go into the military. And there are a lot of good people and responsible people. When you go into the military, they face very tough situations. Do I believe that what happened in this unit was acceptable? Absolutely not. And we need to make sure that the men and women in charge in all of the military branches are going to ensure that every person is treated with the fairness and the equalness that needs to happen as they are trained to defend us.
U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as always, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
With us now is Dawood Waleed, who's the executive director of the Michigan chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Welcome. And we should note as we begin talking that you are a military veteran.
That is correct. I served for 4 years in the United States Navy.
And what years did you serve?
From 1994 to 1998, and I served under honorable conditions and received 2 Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medals.
Well, this week, CARE called for the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department to launch a probe into Raheel's death. And we know there are already 3 investigations, the Marine Corps, the NCIS, which is the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, and a Naval Medical and Surgery Review. Why do you believe that this 4th federal probe is needed?
Well, we believe that Raheel Siddiqui's civil rights were most likely violated just before his declared or reported suicide, which the family still has questions about whether it actually was a suicide or not. But also in my work in the civil rights field, we're always skeptical about people or a particular entity in the government investigating itself and the actions of its own members. Therefore, we believe that not only should the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division investigate the potential violation of Mr. Siddiqui's civil rights, but that there needs to be an outside entity, which is not part of the Department of Defense, that is investigating what took place at that boot camp.
Now, I know that you have met with Raheel Siddiqui's family.
Correct.
You've seen the postmortem pictures.
That's correct.
What were your thoughts when the word came down from the Marines that it looked like possible suicide?
It was very questionable in my mind. This was an honor roll student. People in the community and Taylor had nothing but stellar things to say about him. He had very high engineering ambitions to even wanting to serve our country as an FBI agent. He also had no history of any type of mental health issues or diagnosed with any type of depression or anything like that. So for a man with such high ambitions to be described as nothing but helpful and jovial, both by family members and community members, to then suddenly just commit suicide seems extremely bizarre, to say the least.
We all know Marine boot camp is one of the toughest experiences that anybody could go through. What have you heard that makes you believe that this young recruit was singled out for particularly vicious hazing because of being Muslim American?
Well, I think the primary reason is actually the history of the drill instructor that came out. There was another Muslim who filed a complaint against the same drill instructor only months before Siddiqui's death. This young man was humiliated. He was made to lay face first down the shower. He was then, after being made to be wet, he was then forced to go into an industrial size dryer in which it was turned on, and he suffered burns as well as being accused of being a spy and a terrorist. So,
and this is the same drill instructor.
This is the exact same drill instructor. So there's a history here of racism and xenophobia with this one particular drill instructor. But the culture in which there were so many people who witnessed these events and didn't say anything just reminds me of the culture of the military in which I served, in which there are people who have positional power, who cover for themselves, and then the people who are the recruits or the so-called subordinates are hazed and made to suffer. And in particular, those people who are different are those who are most vulnerable to being hazed.
So this fits with what you're hearing from other branches of the military and other recruits or other military members?
Our offices at CARE across the country over various years have received complaints in relationship to this. You know, when CARE first got started, and I didn't even think about filing a complaint with CARE, but I filed a complaint with the what is called the Master at Arms in my unit.
Tell us about your experience.
About 20 years ago when we were enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq. And I remember vividly there was actually 2 people in my division, both Michiganians, as a matter of fact, started yelling and chanting, saying, "We're going to bomb your people, boy." So we're around the same age. They called me boy. I'm an African-American. But then the next morning, after I wake up at what we call our rack, I opened up my drape, and there was a noose hanging next to my rack. So the the Master at Arms investigated, and they did not find the individuals who were responsible. But it's just very, you know, interesting that even on that one particular incident, among others, you know, that I was subjected to racism and Islamophobia while serving. And mind you, this was 20 years ago, prior to 9/11. So imagine the environment right now, around the 15th anniversary of 9/11, the very caustic political rhetoric that is coming from Donald Trump and others who have Tea Party affiliations. I can't even imagine what recruits and active service members may be experiencing right now, both here and deployed abroad.
If you were a young person, a minority, Muslim, considering joining America's military today, would you reconsider?
I would think twice about it if, you know, if I could fast forward 20 years ago when I was that young man who was in his early 20s signing up for the United States military. I'm not too sure if I would do that right now.
Have you gotten a response from the Department of Justice to your call for an investigation, civil rights investigation?
No, we just made the call yesterday, and we'll see what takes place. But as we stated yesterday, we do believe that the serious nature of what took place does rise to a level that the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division should look into this particular situation. But also there needs to be a review of the broader culture that is right now in the United States military. We don't believe that the vast majority of people in the United States military are Islamophobic, but we do know that there is a problem. We do also know that there is implicit bias that takes place in our society. So people may not have malicious intent, but it doesn't mean that they're free of implicit bias and can't treat people different ways and that there's double standards.
Dawood Waleed, who is Executive Director of CARE, the Michigan Chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I misspoke in the introduction to this interview, and I want to be extremely clear. Marine recruit Raheel Siddiqui was a Pakistani-American Muslim. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It used to be getting to school meant hopping on your bike. Those bike racks outside the schools would be full, but times have changed. When Ty Schmidt moved to Traverse City 10 years ago, something struck him. No kids were riding bikes to school, and there were long lines of cars at drop-off and pickup. That observation led Ty and his wife, Joanna, to launch an effort to get kids to ride their bikes safely to and from school. And from that grew an all-out effort to build a more bike-friendly Traverse City, inspiring its kids through bicycles. Their group is called Norte, and Ty Schmidt is with us now. Hello, Ty.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So happy to have you with us. So there you are, a newcomer to Traverse City. So you're kind of looking with new eyes. And where had you come from?
Well, I grew up in Manitoba near Winnipeg, but then I had moved to Tucson after graduating. I'm a physical therapist, so I moved somewhere warm, so I moved to Tucson. And then I met my wife down there, and we moved back home where she grew up here in Traverse City in 2006.
And there you kind of, you know, look at the situation at school, and it's something that's repeated all over the state, the big, long line of cars dropping off and picking up. What got you the idea, planted that idea that, hey, let's see if we can get kids to get on their bicycles?
Yeah, you know, and it's something that certainly isn't unique to Traverse City, Michigan. I mean, it's happening all across the U.S., you know, and it's the new normal now is to drive your kid to school. And it's something that, you know, it really bothered me. And it's something that, because I job share with my wife, I have the luxury of time. I was like, you know what, we're going to invite some kids over. I'm going to pedal them to school in the morning. My wife will pedal them back in the afternoon, and we'll just see where it goes. And we started 3 years ago with a couple kids, and this morning we just had like 18 kids like to school with us this morning. So it's funny how it's taken off, but it's been really rewarding.
And it's actually spread to other schools and other neighborhoods, hasn't it?
Right. And so, you know, the kind of light bulb went off as like this type of model, because parents are busy. You know, the mornings are hectic. They may want their kid to walk or bike to school. But so we're here to make it easy, and we're trying to connect with parents with time and the energy. And so we started with one bike train that connected to Eastern Elementary, but now we have 18 bike trains that connects to 9 different schools from 12 different neighborhoods in Traverse City.
And then you also realized you needed to teach children how to ride their bikes safely, didn't you?
Right. You know, and that's the part of this bike train model is not just shepherding them, getting them from point A to point B, but every trip is a teaching moment. So we really take the time to emphasize how it is to ride intelligently and safely. And so, you know, we really take it serious. You know, they signal, they stop at every stop sign, and they just, their confidence builds, their independence builds, and it's something that as they get older, it'll be lifelong skills.
And then from that acorn grew Norte, bike-centric, youth-focused. And you have such a interesting, large array of programs aimed at getting kids and adults on their bikes.
Yeah, you know, and it's something that we are youth-centric, but we're not youth-only. And we started doing a social ride, a slow roll in Traverse City during the summers, and it really turned into be a multi-generational thing, you know, grandmas and millennials and everybody in between. The idea of people on bikes creates more people on bikes. And, you know, we really try to push the social aspect of meeting neighbors. And, you know, the exercise is great, but it's that connecting to people and place that's really been great.
And then you decided to move into mountain bikes, because I noticed you've got a number of programs, including the one I love, Chicas del Norte, a Girls on Bikes Empowerment Program.
Oh, man. You know, and it's something that's taken off this year. It's like one of the things that I really felt like we weren't doing well. We weren't getting enough little girls on bikes. And this summer has been so cool to see. And every Sunday we come out and we ride bikes together, because really it's, you know, if there's one place to learn how to ride a bike, it's in the woods, and it's so much fun, and there's just tons of smiles. And these girls love to, you know, we're not trying to separate boys and girls, but they're just a little different. They socialize, they chat, they wait for each other, and it's been great to have them and grow that program.
Ty, why have you seen it so crucial and important to get kids on their bikes? What's happening, and how is that part of empowering them?
Well, you know, it's something that it's, you know, in my kids too, I just see so many kids tapping screens and sitting. And, you know, I'm a physical therapist, so I'm fully aware of the health impacts and the idea that we need to move more and sit less. But then it also branches out, not just from schools, but into the community, that we can get around town on our bicycles. We do not need a car for 90% of our trips within 2 miles. And it's something just to start a conversation about what it means to have a sustainable, strong community. And here in Traverse City, we're lucky that it's a pretty dense, we have a nice grid. It's very, you know, the streets, the infrastructure is improving, you know, so it's a easy sell.
And what do you say to people who feel concern about bicycling with distracted texting car drivers going alongside them on the roads?
Yeah, and it's the number one concern, right? I mean, safety is the number one thing with parents, with teachers, with principals, with administrators. And it's something that we really drive home with the kids, that it is super important, because we're on the street, you know, we don't ride on the sidewalk. And we're really talking about, how do we design, you know, how can we improve our infrastructure to improve safety? Because, you know, Norte does a great job of encouraging and being cheerleaders, but without safe design and infrastructure, you know, it won't go anywhere. And so I'm excited that we're going to actually partner with the city here soon to start making some changes for safe ways to get to and from school.
That's great. I mean, I'm just thinking, I'm a baby boomer, and that bicycle was the ticket to freedom. And you get on, I remember getting on my bike on a summer day, and I could go anywhere I wanted in downtown Ferndale. And I used to pretend when I was quite young that I was riding a horse and I was being a cowboy. But the sense of freedom was there, but I didn't have to deal with the fact that you had drivers and you stop at any light and everybody's got their phones out. I don't care.
Right. What? No, it's true.
Yeah.
And you're right. And I want my kids, and I want my neighborhood's kids, and I want people who I don't know's kids to really have that experience like you and I did growing up. You know, you take a left, you take a right, and you're gone, you know, and that idea about what I want is the idea of visibility. And I'm not talking about reflectors or yellow jackets, but the idea that if we can get more people on bikes, then drivers expect to see us out on our bikes, you know. And I'm not talking about racers and spandex. I'm just talking about ordinary people in ordinary bikes doing ordinary things. And I think that visibility and that awareness is key.
Can other cities and towns take what you've done, Ty, and adapt it to their areas?
Absolutely. You know, nothing we've done is innovative. And to be honest, a lot of the things we've done, we've borrowed from other communities across the U.S. And I think that the idea is to make friends with awesome people. And I've learned that, you know, you can't do this yourself. So, you know, we have a dedicated board now. We have tons of volunteers. We have community partners. My only advice would be to just to start small. and dream big and not bite off more than you can chew. But it's something that I think is important, and it's not just important for our kids, but I really feel like it's important for Traverse City.
Ty, I noticed as I look on your website, elgruponorte.org, a very strong Spanish influence, not only in the name of your group, but, you know, like we talked about, the Chicas del Norte or El Barrio Bike Fix. What's with the Spanish influence?
I know. Everybody is like, what's up with the Spanish? I'm a white guy from Canada who can barely speak a lick of Spanish, but I'm trying. And every day I'm like an aspiring Spanish speaker. But I met my wife in Tucson, fell in love with her and the culture. And then we moved north, Norte, so it's a little bit of a mashup of being up north here in Traverse City and coming from Tucson. So, you know, it's an odd name, but it's catching on. And I think people are associating Norte with people on bikes in Traverse City.
And the energy is good because it's Norte exclamation point.
Exactly. It's exciting.
The website is elgruponorte.org. We put up a link on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. And it's really worth diving in, taking a look at Ty's website. It was really great talking with you. Ty Schmidt, who is the founder, along with his wife, Joanna, of Norte.
Thank you.
Good news for history lovers all across the state. Michigan's historical groups can apply for small grants to help preserve historical records and make them publicly accessible. The Michigan State Historical Records Advisory Board has announced grants of up to $2,000 are available through the Save Michigan History Program. They point out people expect historical records to be available, but paying for their preservation is quite a challenge. Applications are due by March 1st. You may remember from your school days, one of the ways geologists measure time is by epochs, which can be seen in changes in rock layers. They tell us much about what was going on the Earth at that time. A group of scientists thinks it is time we declare a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. Anthro is the Greek word for humans, and that's the big story here. Ben A. Vanderplimes, a professor of geology and the environment at the University of Michigan's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Ben, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Before we talk about this proposed new epoch, explain that whole concept of epoch. Refresh our memories for those of us that did not follow your course and become geologists.
Yeah, of course, the planet has a very long history. It's a 4.5 billion year old planet. And what we do is we look at the history of the planet by major events that took place in that history. And when we see those events, we break that down into these windows of time. And we have many of them because there's a long history here. And when we see a big change, we design a boundary. And this is one of those times where we're discussing whether or not we should have a new boundary because the changes today, the recent changes, are sufficiently large that they truly are changing the geology of our planet. These are not just changes that are small in scale. These are very large changes. And that's usually what a geologic event is. It's a global change. And this term Anthropocene is trying to capture the fact that the events today are sufficiently large that they're geologic events and not just human events.
And what's the importance of that name, Anthropocene?
So it's very important to realize, of course, that some of this is technical, meaning geologists like to divide this stuff up, and that may be a little boring, and it probably is a little boring. But really, what's underlying it is not at all boring. That is the fact that we are changing our planet in a very significant way, meaning the atmosphere is changing, the oceans are changing, the land surface is changing. And so while it's a bit of a technical discussion about a new epoch, and even the term epoch is debated, whether it's the right term for this particular case, it's the underlying process. It's incredibly large and important. And that's really what we should think about and understand.
Did I see somewhere in all of this that scientists actually are calling this the sixth extinction in Earth's history?
Yeah, so one of the classic things that we've done in the geologic record is based the subdivision of the record on the history of life. Geologists are able to look at life, well, actually to look at death, to look at fossils, but life and the evolution of life as being the primary way we divided up the geologic record. And so one of the big steps in the record are what we call major extinctions. And extinctions mean a lot of species just don't survive. However, we're in the middle of that. So it's not that something happened 500 years ago or something like that. It is the idea that because of how we're changing the environment, we are also changing the niche for a lot of species. And in doing so, those species go extinct. And that is what extinctions are all about.
When did this start? And you say we're in the middle of it.
Yeah. The debate, of course, is if humans have become a geologic driver, so when did that start? A lot of attention is given to this idea that it's a very recent event that you could say maybe in the 50s. But others have said, well, we should look farther back. We should look at when we started to change the atmosphere. For example, when we started to have the Industrial Revolution, when we started to actually change very much how we are using the service of the planet and the resources. And yet others have argued that we should look farther back, when humans started to become farmers, when we had agricultural practices that changed the surface of the planet.
So certainly when this started is certainly under debate.
Absolutely.
But it seems that amongst the scientific community, there's really not any dispute that we are in the middle of intense change caused by humans. What would adopting this new name for this new epoch of Anthropocene, human caused, what might that do to influence our behavior as humans?
Well, the first thing it does is it makes us aware that we have a responsibility for our planet. It's more than just being part of it. We are, in part, driving it, and therefore we should think about stewardship. Now, the best example certainly is this discussion about climate change. When I went to school, and it's a few years now, I still learned that we are heading to a new ice age. And that was because we anticipated that the atmospheric conditions would be such that we would slowly see in the years ahead a dropping of temperature. Well, that has changed. We see that that change in temperature is the other direction. It's actually warming up more so than it has done ever before in this ice age window that we've been in so far. Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps the best way to recognize that we have changed how the things have shifted. And the climate would have predicted an ice age down the road. It's not very likely that that's in the short term going to happen with ice melting. And so the best way to understand climate change is to look at the record, whereby we have a prediction from the record and we're seeing the opposite taking place.
And yet it's still such a line of division between those who deny and say, no, it's not, and those who are so frustrated with that. And you just wonder, can we as humans, as humanity, ever come together and affect the kind of change that's needed, or is it already too late?
I'm always very much of an optimist in this discussion. The terms like too late or we're doomed doesn't really help us very much. Also, we're pretty clever. Humans are pretty clever. We have a history of doing a lot of clever stuff. We just have to understand what's taking place, and we have to understand it has implications. The challenges of the changes are not just for the rest of the ecosystem, but also for us. We'll see a warmer climate. We will see diseases differently in different places than we've seen before. We see sea level rise. If nothing else, the coastal areas are the first to alert us to that. We have to understand that these changes that are taking place are affecting us directly. And that's really what the discussion should be about. It's not so much about the finger pointing that humans are bad and we should never have done this. The changes are underway, and they're frankly not readily stoppable. The atmospheric change is not something we can change tomorrow. Even if we are very clever, we do all kinds of engineering tricks. At best we can do is adapt a little bit and adjust to it. But the changes are underway, and they'll play out over geologic time, over longer times than you are in my life. And that's the hard thing in this discussion. You and I don't see change that easily. If it's a little warmer, we say there's a cold winter or there's a warm winter. Geology does not work in my and your time scale. It works in its own time scale. But these changes are affecting us. We need to understand them because we have to adapt to them. And I said sea level rise is perhaps maybe the best way to immediately think about that. There's a lot of coastal areas and cities that will be under great pressure.
Now, this new name, Anthropocene, has not been formally adopted, but there's going to be a scientific process. And, I mean, what might it take? A lot more discussion before someone officially declares we are in the Anthropocene epoch?
Yeah, that's of course, the technical side of it. So
yeah.
There is a committee, and I must honestly tell you, I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. We've never done something so dramatic as decide on a new epoch. This is a big thing. We usually look back and adjust the record based on information. Now we are in that change, and we have to decide, is that big enough a change to change that record? Down the road, maybe it will take a few more years. I'm sure that the hand-wringing about where to draw the boundary is far from over. But all of us agree, that is those who've studied these topics, that the changes are large enough to truly expect that a boundary like that has a place.
Ben A. Vanderpleim is professor of geology and the environment at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for bringing this expertise and helping us understand this story.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The State Board of Education has just voted along party lines, a 6-2 vote, to approve revised school guidelines
to offer a safe, supportive environment for Michigan students who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. The board's first set of proposed guidelines was posted earlier this year for public comment, and over 13,000 comments were posted, both pro and con. From that came these revised guidelines. Here with us, the president of the State Board of Education, John Austin, welcome. And let's start by talking about why these guidelines, these set of practices and policies, are needed. A survey done by the Centers for Disease Control indicates Michigan is not a very supportive place if you are LGBT.
I'm glad you mentioned it. This is the most recent evidence that, you know, our 150,000 of our young people are LGB, and some growing thousands who are comfortable being who they are, transgender. And those young people are much more likely to be at risk of being put upon, violence, assault, bullying. They're also not engaged in learning when they're afraid to go to school, twice as likely to drop out of school, skip school because the environment is not supportive, five times as likely to have attempted their own life. So we have much to do to make sure that a significant number of our kids are able to engage with school and be accepted and be supported to get a great education like everybody deserves. All of those bad numbers, and we're, again, among the bottom in the country in the school environment for that welcomes LGBT young people, mm-hmm. all that goes away when there is a welcome and supportive environment at school and, you know, you hope in the home as well. But the school we can encourage, and that's what this guidance does. It says, here's some best practices. Here's the kind of ways you can welcome, support, and help engage and go about the business of learning for this significant number of our young people who deserve a great education and also deserve to be safe and treated with dignity and respect like everybody else.
And we need to underscore, these are not mandates. These are suggestions. They're guidelines.
Now, we know when it came from the field. I mean, educators around the state wanted to know what are the ways to create an environment that supports and engages and welcomes LGBT young people. Many schools in Michigan are already deploying the kinds of best practices that are in this recommended guidance. But for those who aren't, they were looking for what do we do and how do we develop policies and practices that really support and celebrate and welcome and acknowledge these kids and meet their unique mm-hmm. learning needs as well as treat the kind of health and safety challenges that they face very disproportionate from other kids. Just as we would for any group of kids who have particular learning challenges, what do we do about our English language, non-English language speakers? How do we make sure they engage and get educated? How would we do better by our special education kids? How do we treat the unique challenges that African-American males face of being suspended and misunderstood? These are all particular challenges that different groups of kids have, but it's all about helping them stay in school, be accepted, be supported,
and
go about the business of learning and not drop out of school or put, even worse, themselves at risk and their health and safety at risk.
John Austin, I want to talk about the response to that first set of proposed guidelines that went up last spring for public comment. So for many of the public comment sections on issues that the Board of Education posts, you'll see 7 or 10 or maybe a couple of dozen comments. This one, over 13,000. What did that outpouring response say to you personally?
Well, it said that this is A, an important, and B, a topic that we're still learning how to address as a society and as a state. As you've seen around the country, the discussion about LGBT rights, a group that is often among the most ostracized and still attacked and vilified, mm-hmm. and transgender people and young people emerging as a hot topic around how are we beginning to understand, as we have with gay people now, hopefully for some time, that there are transgender people. It's who they are. It's not a lifestyle choice or a game. And they have the same rights, privileges, and ability to be hopefully treated with dignity and respect as all people. And that's part of what you saw in terms of the reaction. Now, I will say, you know, from the get-go, the guidance that was developed, it was actually heralded by many around the country as a real model. Mm-hmm. And all of the folks who work with young people, the associations of social workers, psychiatrists, the pediatricians, the educator groups, the Michigan Parent Teacher Association, all of them weighed in support of the guidance because they appreciate that these are real learning and life and safety challenges that can be ameliorated if schools help develop the kind of practices and programs and real recognition of LGBT kids that is the key for them thriving and not feeling shoved aside or shunted, and then they can go about the business of learning. So the professionals who work with young people really appreciate that this is important and we can solve these challenges and help these kids learn. There was some of it fanned deliberately, misunderstanding and fears of mm-hmm. transgender people and kids. Mm-hmm. Some of it was unfortunate pot stirring by anti-Common Core groups, why they care about LGBT kids, I have no idea. But legitimate concerns about from parents and others.
Yeah, and I want to ask
that
you
we,
about
you know,
those.
That we did listen to, and the guidance has been significantly clarified and improved to meet those legitimate concerns. I mean, and the two most.
Yeah, let's talk about, because I wondered as you read these comments opposing the guidelines as that first draft came out, and you saw something and you went, oh, okay, they've got a point there. We can address that. So what kind of points did you feel like, all right, there is a legitimate concern here?
Well, there were two main topics of discussion mm-hmm. and concern. One was parental involvement and notification. If your son or daughter is transgender, are they by themselves switching their identity mm-hmm. with no parental notification involvement? And the guidance is now very clearly stating, of course we want parents involved. Parents should work with the school to decide how their daughter or son should be treated, named, et cetera.
Pronouns to be used, yes.
With the caveat that there may be some rare instances, just as there are very rare instances where there is abuse in the home, where educators can use their good judgment if the child's coming out to their parents. May put them at physical harm or safety risk. Educators can help determine that and treat each case on a case-by-case basis, and that seems very commonsensical.
That's right.
The other main topic was changing rooms and bathrooms.
We had to get to that. That bathroom right. and locker room issue is such a hot-button issue.
And, you know, again, we encourage, and the guidance is very clear, there are lots of ways, and we encourage them and give examples where you can meet the needs of all kids to have a private or comfortable or safe place to go to the bathroom. You know, encourage, of course, gender-neutral bathrooms are often the best solution, and including what a transgender child will most often want. The right for privacy or private changing area in the locker room, that should be available for all young people that want it, not just transgender kids. But it does remind districts that under the current civil rights law interpretation, transgender children are able to, and their right is to go to the gender, the bathroom and the locker room of their gender identity. And that's just a reminder, the civil rights law as it stands, it's being challenged, but I think it'll likely hold in terms of the appropriate interpretation, suggests that, yes, transgender children have the right to go to the bathroom if they choose of their gender identity.
We saw an immediate response from Senator Tom Casperson with a proposed bill that would very much change that conversation and change that point
right,
of view.
The bathroom bills. But the other thing that this guidance does, and it's mm-hmm. very important, it sends a message about who we are in Michigan. Yes, we are a state that in our public policies, in our voluntary encouragement to school districts, that we really do want to be welcoming and inclusive. And we do want to respect and acknowledge LGBT young people and adults. And that's an important message to send. The bathroom bills, like in North Carolina, and what was proposed here in response to this, again, voluntary encouragement to schools to create a safe learning environment, they send a terrible message. They're basically saying, we don't want you here. We don't acknowledge you exist, LGBT young people or adults, and we're going to dictate your gender identity. And that's a terrible message, and you see what happened when it was sent in North Carolina. You have companies from, you know, Target to PayPal and even the NBA saying, mm-hmm. we're not going to do business with a state that is sending messages that you're discriminating, basically, against some of your people.
Well, John, how did you respond? And I'm sure you, through the months since these guidelines first came out for public comment and you'd encounter people, there was a real strong strain of concern from parents who just said, I don't know what my little girl's going to make of somebody who'd been in her class as a boy since kindergarten and suddenly coming into her locker room as a female in fifth grade. So there was a lot of concern about, what about my kids' rights? So how did you respond to that?
Well, the kids actually get it. I mean, they're, if anything, this next generation is more welcoming and supportive that there are gender identities that both blur and are different than what the older generation, you know, it's you're male or female and that's it. And we're at a point now in society, in this country, where just as maybe 15 or 20 years ago, we began to acknowledge, look, there are gay people. There probably always have been. And they deserve the same rights and dignity. And they're my friends and my neighbors and even my spouse or siblings. There are transgender people and transgender school children. And they deserve to be embraced and supported and acknowledged. And also, there's never been an episode of transgender people attacking other people. They are the victims of abuse, as that CDC study showed. They're twice as likely, LGBT young people, twice as likely in Michigan and elsewhere to be the targets of violence and sexual abuse. And so they're not the ones causing problems in the bathrooms. They're trying to fit in as a boy or as a girl. And the other kids accept them. And I think, you know, hopefully more adults can accept them as well, because this is who they are.
The guidelines are lengthy, but if you were to summarize these guidelines that you are revealing today after you know, being worked on following review of the comments, what do they say?
They say, here's a set of common sense things schools can do to create an environment that acknowledges, respects, and supports and is supportive of LGBT young people so they can stay in school and be going about the business of learning. It also points out how transgender youth can be both acknowledged, respected, and have their rights respected, but all in the context of local schools working out the best approach to solve what appear to be sticky issues like bathrooms and locker rooms that maximize the health and safety and comfort of all the kids and respect the rights of the LGBT kids. It can be done. But I think, as I indicated, the guidance sends a message that, yes, we want to be supportive and inclusive and welcoming of all of our people in our great diversity, and we want them to get a great education. And right now they're not. And if for any reason any kid is not sticking in school or is putting themselves, their health or safety is at risk, that's our job to create an environment where they thrive and can learn and can go about having a great life. And that's what this guidance is mostly about.
John Austin, president of the State Board of Education. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As part of our series, Minding Michigan, we explore mental health issues in our state. Today, we introduce you to Patrick Cleland, better known as Rick Chime. He's a rapper from West Michigan with new music released earlier this year, and he's collaborating with local artists around the state with several projects in the works. Despite that success, Chime struggles with depression, and he talks about it in his newest album. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has this profile.
Those who know Rick Chime call him a wordsmith, a hip-hop poet. His newest album, Bald Since Birth, was produced with friend Nixon. Together, they mix beats with lyrics to form a blend of hip-hop and spoken word. Chime has been busy this year with collaborations, including this one with indie folk band The Accidentals.
I don't have the patience to stay here. Traveled hours in a van just to play here. And I know if we stop for too long, I might fall for this dot on the globe. Peace and take care.
Get me out. Get me out.
Then there was a dance film made to his original track called Pull Me Back off his newest album.
Beats telling me keep rhyming because it's what I need. I am sensing you're feeling that I've been whining enough.
Every time I think I've found a way to get about you, pull me back.
As a kid, Chime was obsessed with basketball. He played in high school and some in college. But at the age of 15, his dad died in a plane accident, and that really changed the direction of his life.
After the plane crash happened, I submersed myself even further into basketball and at the same time into hip-hop.
Selfish, crashed in that plane, abandoned us for some reason, never sought to talk to someone with the training that could help me make some sense of what was going on inside my head.
Each song on the album tells a part of Chime's story, from the loss of his dad to where he is today. He began writing the lyrics shortly after Art Prize 2013. That's the year he performed a 17 and a half hour freestyle rap.
it was in pursuit of a Guinness Book record, and that was, you could only start for 5 seconds, and there was just consistent content coming from all these different sources.
Chime did not get that record for longest freestyle rap, but people were paying attention, and he was gaining notoriety. Still, something was off.
Here's all this love coming and almost feeling like you don't deserve it.
Chime had a feeling his depression was keeping him from truly being comfortable in his own skin, but he didn't know what to do about it.
Because I didn't love myself and I was getting all this validation from the outside, once I eventually started to receive these things that I thought were going to bring happiness, and they didn't, a huge wake-up call, and once I started to do the work to break down some of the negative routines and replace them with positive, things started to fall in place.
Around the same time, Chime started working with the Mental Health Foundation of West Michigan. He was learning about mental health first aid and using his music to connect with kids.
I'm using the music as a vehicle to articulate these messages to these young people. But at the same time, I'm learning what the signs and symptoms of depression and about mental illness are myself.
Chime finally found the help he was looking for. He wrote a full-length album documenting his journey. And he says if other people can put the stigma behind them, they can get the help that they want.
And a lot of people are sitting there knowing that they could probably benefit from an outside perspective, someone with professional training. There's a difference between knowing that and going and making that move to put yourself out there. And a lot of that's because of the stigma that surrounds it. And we've been taught that vulnerability isn't strength. And it's pretty much the opposite, I believe. And there's nothing wrong with going to get a coach. Don't think that you have to navigate it as a solo mission.
Chime continues to talk with young people about suicide prevention and the signs and symptoms of depression. He also mentors young rappers.
If you're with me, you should rip your mixture. Perfect your recipe, dutifully risk for.
The last song on his album is called Today, and it strikes a hopeful note. Chime says he's committed to finding balance in his life, and he encourages others to do the same. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
State isn't measured by money. If I'm great, it's not because they all love me, but from work put in much prior to us meeting. I'm wondering if someone's gonna hear this and start working towards something. Start working towards something. I wipe the sleep from my eyes. Hello to another 24. It's great to meet you today. It could be spectacular. Let's take a stroll for like 86,000 seconds. Plus a couple more for good measure and then refresh it. Wipe the sleep from my eyes. Hello to another 24. It's great to meet you today. It could be spectacular. Let's take a stroll for like 86,000 seconds. I'm doing this for Barbara, for Deborah, for Norma Ann, for Phils, for Bowsman Schultz, any person I've shaken hands with. I'm doing this for Jody, for babies, for me, for Kendrick, for Brian, Casey, Kyle, though, for Morgan, for New, for them that for some reason connected. We met out here in the field.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, and our engineer was Bob Scott. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Liz Dickey. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
The same. All of us are so important. I wouldn't trade in this brain if I could, but making upgrades is something I'm doing daily. Whatever this means.